It's the amazing Randy Redux edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Not So Catholic Canada, Breaking the Light Barrier, Science and You, and an interview with the amazing Randy. Let's begin episode 134.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
Jenna, back with you, your biochemist.
You know, I've got great news this week. Great news for all the communists out there.
Oh my goodness, did you bring cupcakes? Communist cupcakes?
No.
Oh,
better than that. Apparently, the USSR has been restored. Woohoo! Former Prime Minister Vladimir Putin and current Prime Minister Putin, former president, will once again apparently run for president. There's not expected to be much opposition to this. So, sorry, I'm using new technology and I just lost my spot. So I'm going to go back to the old stuff and figure out how this goes. As I was saying, Prime Minister Putin, formerly President Putin, will once again run for president. There's not expected to be much opposition. Then the current president, Medvedev, whom Putin personally suggested should be his successor, will swap and become prime minister, all according to a plan the two apparently agreed to in 2008 before Medvedev became president. So if Putin is the new dictator of Russia, why did he step down from president and just stay there? Well, during the brief period of freedom, the Russian Constitution had stated that there was a term limit for the president for 2 4-year terms. So he had to step down. However, while prime minister, one of his achievements, Medvedev as president, laid claim to altering the Constitution to extend each term of the presidency from 4 years to 6 years. So when Putin is elected president in 2012, and there's no doubts that he's going to be elected, he will hold office until 2024, when he will be 72. A little young to retire by dictator standards, but Russia can only hope. I don't know. I kind of miss the old Soviet Union, the old days of, you know, one, you either had the common enemy, you know, someone to fight against, or at least, you know, there was a hope that there was an alternative to what we're living in now. And it looks like Putin is trying to put us back in that old road.
It just confused the heck out of me when I was in grade 2 and 3, because in our classes, USSR stood for Uninterrupted Silent Sustained Reading. And the fact that it was still on the map but didn't exist, confused my young mind to no end.
Maybe that's just what your instructors wanted you to think, and it was really a communist plot.
Well, we did have to read Russian books.
Well, there you go.
Did you read them in a hurry?
You're bad.
Well, let's move on to our first bit of skeptical news today. I came across this story last week. I was flipping through the National Post when I came across a story titled Name Mary's Mother and Other Tests of a Refugee Claim. So I actually blogged about this over the weekend, but I think it's worth discussing more. So what is this story all about? Basically, a refugee from China, a Mr. Mao Quin Wang, fled to Canada because he was being persecuted for his religious beliefs. According to the article, Mr. Wang, 26, says he turned to religion after his father was seriously injured in an accident and a friendly Catholic said he was praying for him. When his father improved, he started to attend his friend's underground church in 2007.
I like it. It's like evidence-based, you know?
Sure. However, the Chinese government shut down his church, calling it an illegal religious establishment. They soon came after him as well, and so Mr. Wang decided to flee the country. He paid a smuggler $30,000 to get him to Canada, and he filed for refugee status, saying that he would face arrest, jail, and maltreatment because of his religious beliefs if returned to Canada. Or returned to China, sorry. So apparently, the next step for Mr. Wang was to prove he was Catholic enough. I guess, because here in Canada, we can't just let the floodgates open up to anyone fleeing religious persecution. You need to really prove that you're religious and that you're being persecuted. Otherwise...
Did it have to be the right religion? I mean, if he was Buddhist, would we have let him in for persecution?
Possibly, but I guess there is a danger of Canada being overrun with fake Catholics in this case. Perhaps an expert on immigration could inform you on the true danger of fake Catholics. But anyway, Mr. Wang fell into the hands.
Real Catholics are dangerous enough.
Yeah, well, that's another point for another day. Mr. Wang fell into the hands of Rose Anderchuk, an IRB educator who previously was chairwoman of the Toronto Catholic District School Board. Anderchuk decided to quiz Wang on his knowledge of Catholic dogma to see just what sort of Catholic he was. Turns out Wang isn't so up to speed on the finer points of Catholicism. When asked who was Mary's mother and who was John the Baptist's mother, Wang was clueless. And of course the answer is... Anne and Elizabeth? Hello?
Oh.
To quote the article again, the claimant was asked whether the consecrated water and wafer and bread represents the body of Jesus, or whether it is the body, or whether it is the symbolic representation of Jesus.
I think that's actually whether it's a symbolic representation or whether it's the actual body of Jesus.
And the claimant responded that it was the representation of Jesus, not the actual body of Jesus.
So did he answer this because, one, he belonged to one of the many sects of Catholicism, or he was just rational and knew that, you know, I might believe in this theory, but I'm not nuts?
It doesn't say, but we can continue here. To quote again, the claimant was asked to tell the panel what happens at Mass from beginning to end, and Mr. Wang listed the introductory rites, the liturgy of the word, the liturgy of the Eucharist, and conclusion rites, which is all correct. He was asked to explain the introductory rites. He replied that it is sprinkling of water and priest blessings, which are apparently not part of introductory rites. So, not only is this guy potentially a fake Catholic, he sounds like a Protestant, which is awful. So, to summarize, Wang knew Mary was Jesus' mom and that Jesus was baptized by the aptly named John the Baptist, but he couldn't
name... That
one's
a really tricky one.
Yeah. Well, he couldn't name Mary and John's mothers. Wang correctly answered questions about the rosary and the seven sacraments. He named the books of the Old Testament but didn't know what they were about. And he failed to note that 2009 was dedicated to St. Paul by the Catholic Church, that bastard.
Yeah, you know, this. We were talking about this before, and this strikes me as what they used to do with the Jim Crow laws in the States to try and prevent black people from voting. You know, they'd ask some sort of simple questions and come with something that you just couldn't possibly answer. And I mean, okay, maybe if I was the Pope, I would know these answers. But this guy, I mean, he's in China. He's newly converted to Catholicism. And this isn't, you know, the Catholicism I have down the street. This is a hidden church in China. So we're not talking about something that you would expect doctrine to be strictly upheld to.
Exactly. So based on all of this, Anderchuk ruled that Wang was unlikely to be a real Catholic. Mr. Wang appealed this decision to the Federal Court of Canada, where it was decided that Mr. Wang was held to a, quote, unreasonably high standard of religious knowledge. So his case is now being reviewed by, I would assume, reasonable people. But there's a few rather disturbing, I think, noteworthy issues here that are worthy of discussion. One, Anderchuk's high standards of what qualifies a Catholic. Now, really, who is she to decide who meets that criteria in the first place?
I might point out, one, the government of Canada sort of does, and two, what gives the Pope the authorization to do that?
I also think that, I mean, her decision probably wasn't trying to decide, you know, are you a good enough Catholic to enter Canada so much as the central tenet of your claim as a refugee is that you are a Catholic. Is that true, or is this a line that you thought would get you in? So, I mean, not to defend this woman, because I also believe that this is an unreasonably high standard of religious knowledge, but her motives were probably not to sort of defend the validity and sort of ivory tower of Catholicism within Canada, but to determine whether he was being truthful in his reasons for making a claim.
But if this isn't the standards of Catholicism that we expect in Canada, why is he being held to that standard?
I think it was her trying to decide whether or not he was lying about being a Catholic in the first place and being totally out to lunch on what most Catholics know.
So what I think Jen is kind of trying to point to is that if he had said that he was a Pentecostal, or if he said that he was escaping because he was missing a leg.
Yeah. Be like, are you actually missing a leg? It's not that everyone
in Canada would have to have two legs.
Yeah.
But if that was the reason you gave to come here, then you have
you better have one leg.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the average Catholic knows the answers to those questions?
No, which is why I think, well, I mean, I don't know for sure. I mean, even I know some of the answers, but I feel that, I agree with the ruling that it was unreasonably high.
Do you think this is a conspiracy that she's attempting to have everyone deported from Canada who is not Catholic enough?
Possibly.
Ooh, maybe she's a member of the atheist movement.
But it does...
a really underground one.
It raises questions about who gets turned away because of these sort of high standards of religious questions.
Well, let's go. I mean, because we kind of have a contrary view about religion in the first place. So one of the things, and we kind of talked about this before, I don't know if I really think that just because this guy was not allowed to practice his religion, that is means in and of itself to grant him refugee status. If they locked him up in jail, if they beat his wife, something like that, that I think would qualify. But to deny him the ability to practice what I consider to be woo, I think any rational person would consider to be woo, is not in and of itself adequate means to be a refugee. Was that all that had happened to him?
Well, I think it was pretty clear that he was facing persecution. I'm not exactly sure to what extent. I mean, He claimed jail. So, I mean, I think that being thrown in jail for believing in woo is pretty objectionable in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, for any belief, as long, you know, it's standards that we generally like to not uphold here in this country.
Right. Well, why don't we go to a quick commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back after this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm this guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star. The planet is just another speck. To think about all of this. To think about the vast emptiness.
Radio Free Thinker is heard Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
We're not only back, we're back faster than the speed of light.
Are we done?
Well, that apparently is a potential claim in the future. There have been a number of stories on the webosphere trumpeting the discovery of faster-than-light particles, something that the theory of relativity states is impossible. Well, to be pedantic, the theory only states that nothing can accelerate beyond the speed of light. There is a theoretical possibility that something could be sort of born faster than light, but that doesn't make... that doesn't make the possibility any more plausible because there's no known way for something to be born at such a speed. Maybe some weird virtual particle, maybe a parallel universe with alternative laws, but I'm not a physicist, theoretical or otherwise, so I'll let the science take the lead on this one. Letting the science take the lead on this one, though, doesn't seem to be something the popular press is doing. A number of articles claiming that Einstein's theory of relativity has been overturned is rushing things a bit, if not a lot.
Wait, Hold up. Are you trying to tell me that the popular media is sensationalizing a finding to make a snappy headline?
No, I'm not saying that.
All right, then we better move on.
I'm just implying it. See, you take my scientific means and you twist it all out of... No. What the researchers really did do is that they fired some neutrinos from an accelerator in Switzerland to a target in Italy. The scientists know to the centimeter the distance between the two points and have calibrated their clocks to within a billionth of a second. They used cesium clocks to be that are accurate to 1 second in 30 million years, or at least we assume, because we haven't actually been here for 30 million years, but I'll let that one go. How this media storm was produced was that when they checked the clocks, it took the neutrinos to travel that distance. They arrived essentially 60 nanoseconds too soon. Why the storm? According to Einstein's theory, nothing can accelerate past the speed of light. Ergo, arriving 60 seconds too soon is, well...
60 breaking. Nanoseconds.
Thank you. 60 nanoseconds too soon breaks the laws. It is regarded the speed of light is regarded as the ultimate stop sign of the universe. The reason you cannot accelerate is not arbitrary. According to the theory, as you accelerate, you gain mass. You also acquire more energy. Both become infinite at the speed of light. Therefore, to accelerate beyond the speed of light would require infinite energy, and an object would be infinitely heavy. If this observation is true, then the theory does not hold. Something, at least, in the math is wrong. Many have speculated that warp drives and other faster-than-light starships are now possible, but such is not the case. First, this is one experiment. There are some possibilities that these results are in error. For example, the exact time of the departure was not directly observed because the CERN lab, the shooter in our tail, does not actually have a neutrino detector. So the departure time was indirectly calculated by protein blobs that created the neutrinos themselves. Also, there may be other unknowns involved. Some have speculated that if this finding were true, then when a supernova event occurred, we should have actually seen the neutrinos significantly sooner than the photons. This was not observed during the 1987 supernova. So again, there is some doubt whether this is true or not. Now, that all being said, the scientists presenting this research are not a bunch of fringe elements. These are not the kind of people saying, hey, my car can run on water and gets a million miles to the gallon, or hey, I've developed a perpetual motion machine. These are honest, reasonable, dedicated scientists.
And to be fair, they're also not the ones talking about warp drives.
No, but they are the ones who do claim to have faster than light speed.
Yeah, it's still a little bit of a leap.
No, but let's... Thank you for your question, because we have to parse out. Warp is a hyperbole, yes. But even if all the neutrinos do is accelerate the speed of light, it rewrites physics as we know it.
It
is not warp drive, but it is in itself a...
Paradigm shifter.
Raise a question, though, but isn't warp drive about folding space? Is that really considered faster than light travel? I was under the impression that warping sort of made space smaller for your ship to go.
Right, so it still qualifies as faster than light travel, although you yourself are not accelerating past the speed of light, because you're warping space... I don't know if this is really tangential to our conversation.
I feel that it is, essential. Considering the fact it doesn't exist.
So you still travel faster in raw sense because of warp drive than at the speed of light, but you yourself don't actually accelerate.
Well, it's okay, Ethan. It's the Scooby-Doo pajamas that are throwing you off today.
So anyhow, these scientists, as I say, they're not fringe scientists. They're dedicated, accepted, accredited scientists. Reviews by other scientists of their work, and more importantly, the researchers' own attempt to eliminate possible alternative answers, fault in the experiment, have all been quite favorably. So everyone says, hey, this experiment was quite well done. You've more than gone past what's expected to eliminate errors that could have occurred to make the reading seem incorrect. And there are plans to upgrade the experimental equipment to ensure greater accuracy and to do what is most important in all science, to replicate the results. If they are successful at doing so, we may well be booking passage on the Starship Enterprise someday. Yes, my hyperbole. Although, not unlike...
Do you think it'd be called the Enterprise, though? I don't know.
Yeah, actually, there is a long tradition to do that started thanks to Roddenberry, but because the very first space shuttle was the Space Shuttle Enterprise.
That's right.
Well, what I really love about this story is that, I mean, strange things happen in science all the time that are, again, those potentially paradigm-shifting ideas. And all too often, you kind of see people sort of hype it up and then walk away because the reproduction...
Are you implying that I was hyping it up and then walking away?
No, but on the scientist point of view, if scientist part, because the reproduction of that experiment is so... Once you've invested a lot of energy telling people about it, to prove yourself wrong is a bit of egg on the face. And so it is really encouraging that these scientists are already stating that they're making plans to improve accuracy, to improve reporting, to really give this a good shot, and seem to be open to the idea that although the observation seems to stand up under the current information, that it might not.
Well, I mean, CERN has been plagued with constant problems ever since they first built the thing. So I think it's only fair that they do a couple more experiments before they kind of, you know, put this one in the bank, so to speak.
Again, they've reported their results honestly. They have done their best to eliminate what they see to be possible faults in their method, but state that, hey, there are many unknown unknowns. So, you know, that's up there.
Even if this result turns out to actually be caused by another phenomenon, that in and of itself could be something really interesting to add to the current theories as opposed to break them down. And if not, we're going to have one heck of a shift. It'll be fun. Mm.
There is one thing I've been so thankful that I have not seen anywhere, is nobody has claimed that the neutrinos are mutating, which of course is a famous line from 2012, the apocalypse movie of last year. But
okay then.
Well, I don't know. Mutating neutrinos scare me a little, and the other thing that sort of scares me...
Segway?
Yeah, no, I got nothing. So, I don't know about you guys, but this past week I have definitely noticed a different climate on the west coast of British Columbia. We seem to have been rapidly descending into fall.
I thought you were talking about Dick Cheney's trip here. Changed the climate as well.
But yeah, that was a little bit of a political climate shift. But I don't know about you guys, but I haven't seen anyone avoiding talking about the weather right now. Nor have we been avoiding hearing about it. But this, for climate change on a larger scale, is starting to become more and more of a problem. So I was reading a blog post on the NPR blogs by Robert Krulwich, talking about why people are avoiding climate change stories. And it was basically precipitated by an anecdote of himself with some scientist that he really respected coming to talk to him, saying, hey, you know, basically pitching a story about climate change, and him immediately turning up his nose and thinking, oh my God, not again, here we go again. And he contests that many people in the media are avoiding producing this content, and that this is a symptom of many people in the general population having sort of a blanket aversion to consuming climate change stories right now. So this at first glance might seem a little strange. I mean, it's definitely a big issue, and it's definitely an important issue, and it's definitely a complicated issue with lots of facets to explore. So you'd think that this would make great news. We endlessly consume speculations on sports teams and political outcomes, which are also complex, although arguably with fewer variables. And there doesn't seem to be much in the way of information fatigue for these type of topics. Public thirst for this type of information seems to come from a sense of import for the outcome. So why does the public have such a hate on for climate-specific stories? This question is especially pertinent when considering that, unlike some of these other issues that we argue about, climate change itself is a scientifically measurable fact, although the reasons for it might not be. The question then becomes why the controversy over something like this, that is not a scientific controversy really at all, and why is there so much anger in the arguments? So one of the reasons I can see is the effect of highly polarized views, that there are extremist voices on both sides of the spectrum. So while some might argue that extremists on the let's recognize and deal with climate change side are not actually extremists but rationalists, I would argue that extremism in general is alienating to most people. and it becomes psychologically easier to avoid having an opinion than to align your thoughts with someone you think is half crazy. So if the goal subconsciously is to not have an opinion, it's clearly easier to do this without information and therefore without consuming climate change related material in the media.
Okay, Jenna. I would have to take issue with the term extremist in this context. Are people who believe in and promote evolution extremist? If I was to argue against gravity and you defended it, are you an extremist? No, I think the term, the idea that there are two sides to every argument, and yes, I mean rational sides, is often false, as in this case. You yourself said the scientific evidence is incontrovertible. Not that some of the details or even the response to climate change is not worthy of much debate, extreme or otherwise. This premise, and I apologize for picking on what I am sure is a minor rhetorical point in your discussion, this point is symptomatic of a broader epidemic that has infected our popular discourse. We are no longer a nation, a society of people with differences of opinion. We have become, and I shall put this in quotes, a polarized nation of extremists on all sides. By acceding to this, you abandon the possibility of compromise as well as conceding the irrational arguments as equivalent to rational ones.
So I agree that, you know, I don't think that believing in climate change, even if you believe in it, you know, beyond all shadow of a doubt, is extreme. What I was actually referring to is an extremism in the communication style of people talking about climate change. I mean, I'm trying to think of a good example, but trying to sort of communicate by shouting at people about climate change and then jumping off of a building,
or
no matter what you might be saying, you know, it being true does not take away the extremism in the way that you're communicating it. And so I still think it has the power to alienate people. So Ursula Goodenough, which I think is an excellent last name, another correspondent for NPR, asked in a blog on her site what motivates climate change deniers. So basically a call out for possible motivations for the climate denial side of the argument. And with this question, she was able to generate some empirical data from nearly 1,000 response emails she received and basically categorize them and analyze them, looking at what are the possible rhyme and reasons for motivations of people who are skeptical of the climate change issue. And we're not even talking about whether or not this is human caused or anything to that effect. It's whether or not it's happening, which, again, isn't really much of a controversy. So she came up with these six categories. Basically, I'm paraphrasing here, but one, that people don't want to change. So, of course, people only change if it's easy or necessary, and it ties into a couple of the other reasons. Number two, that people don't see the immediacy of the issue. So they really only have so much time and energy to care about certain things, and issues in your brain are sort of triaged, and if it isn't seen as an immediate issue, then you're going to sort of push it to one side. Number three, that people hold a confirmation bias for what they had previously as reviews, as their views. So even though, you know, we have all this data that climate change is actually happening, if it doesn't tally with what you thought before, you're going to take that type of data and it's going to carry less weight than other information you're presented with that's already in line with your own views. The fourth reason, the category that she found people sort of the slant to their email went, is that they don't want to align themselves with people on any issue, with people of a different political or ideological belief or even socioeconomic background or cultural group. So if you think someone that you think is fundamentally different from you believes in something like climate change, you might be reluctant to believe in the same thing just because it creates something in common. So if you are, you know, staunchly of a certain political group, if that issue is sometimes put forward by people of the opposite political group, that's going to skew what you feel about the issue itself. Number five, that people don't see the magnitude of the problem. So basically just don't believe how big it is, which is sort of connected to the immediacy issue. And finally, that some people think the whole thing reeks of conspiracy and resent being fed something that they think is a lie. So all of these issues have major emotional baggage that hinders talking about the practical issue in a really rational way.
See, I think these excuses were valid in the 70s, maybe the 80s. But the sad truth is that people did accept
man-made climate change as the problem, wanted in large numbers to fix the problem, believed in a long-term solution. Remember, the Kyoto Protocols were adopted in 1997. The Canadian government first believed in climate change before it didn't. By your logic, the strong incentive was to remain committed to the belief that man-made climate change is true and not to deny it. Let's not forget, climate change denialism is only really started in the late 90s when the protocols were signed and signaled to industry that the political battle was to be had, that if they didn't start doing something, they would be in real danger. After spending millions of dollars over many years, both on media and biostitutes, a term I heard, it's essentially scientists who are willing to sell their credentials for money, it was only about 3 or 4 or 5 years after this that public opinion began to shift to become more climate skeptic position, at least in the U.S., and thankfully less so in civilized countries. For example, according to the Pew Report, in 2006, almost 80% of Americans believed in climate change was real, and 60% was man-made. By 1910, less than 60% thought so, and barely 34% thought it was man-made. So I agree, but not in this case.
So I'm not 100% sure what you're agreeing or disagreeing with, because, I mean, what we're talking about here is that these opinions exist. This isn't categories she made up. They're not sort of motivations that she thought were possible, but things that were actually coming into her inbox. The people were saying these are their motivations for feeling a certain way. And a lot of them are sort of emotionally based. And I agree that there has been a shift in the past couple of decades. And I don't think actually, that any of these excuses are valid. They just might have a place in what motivates people. And the reasons for those motivations coming up now are sort of a different issue. So basically, everybody, again, where do we go, is trying to come up with ways to take the anger and this emotion out of the argument so that we can think rationally about it. Unfortunately, humans are emotional creatures, and we can't take emotion out of everything and make ourselves completely rational. So people have been suggesting that we basically move it from a negative, angry emotion and all these sort of reactionary points that these motivations laid out to something a little more positive, and basically starting from a love of something that is self-motivated and doesn't have to interact or doesn't have to sort of be couched in other people's belief systems as much, so that there's a little less conflict there. So a quote from Jonathan Franzen during a graduation address was that when you stay in your room and rage or sneer or shrug your shoulders, as I did for many years, the world and its problems are impossibly daunting. But when you go out and put yourself in a real relation to real people or even just real animals, there's a very real danger that you might love some of them. And who knows what might happen to you then. So maybe all we need is love.
Maybe. We'll see. But a good segment there, Jenna. We'll have to revisit this, I think, in the future, because this is definitely a theme that's been going around in the skeptical movement about how to properly communicate. But let's go to a commercial break. When we come back, we'll have our interview with James the Amazing Randy. So stay tuned for that.
Is the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is James the Amazing Randy, founder of the James Randi Educational Foundation, which hosts the Amazing Meeting as well as the Million Dollar Challenge. Welcome to the show, Randy.
A pleasure to be here, sir.
So this is actually your second appearance on Radio Freethinker. You were our first ever guest on our first ever episode, so we've come full circle.
But I hope this doesn't mean this is the last program.
Oh, absolutely not. No, no. And you're in town for a nine-day speaking tour of Canada, 9 cities in 9 days. That's a very daunting task. What motivated you to take it on?
Desperation. No, actually, I hadn't been back to Canada for quite some time, and I was asked if I would come up here and do this tour, and I accepted with great enthusiasm. Of course, it's good to be back in my original homeland.
That's right. And you kind of had a falling out with Canada, with the RCMP specifically. So will there be any chance of mending the fence with...
If the Mounties show up, I'll be terribly surprised. But if they do, maybe I'll have a chat with them. And let's not put that they arrested me or any such thing. People might make the wrong assumption, and it'll be all over the internet within 20 minutes, as you know. No, the RCMP did something which I consider very unethical and improper for a federal police department to do, and I determined at that point that I could move to the United States with no trouble whatsoever. I already had permanent residence there. And I took citizenship some time after that. Not in vengeance or anything like that, but it gave me more opportunities, I must admit.
And recently, a Toronto-based psychic named Nikki claimed that
A person in Toronto who claims that she's psychic.
Ah.
Named Nikki, yes.
Ah.
Okay,
good point there. She claimed that she would take the Million Dollar Challenge, proving she was a real psychic. She, to quote her, said, "I would say yes, I would take the challenge because I have enough faith in my own abilities, if I was available." So what's the current status of that challenge?
First of all, it should be if I were available. Yes. Nonetheless, it's defunct. We haven't heard from Nikki. She said she'd be back to us in 48 hours. We let 6 days go by and figured that was easily 48 hours, though my mathematics is not that great. It's that good. I would say that Nikki got what we call in the trade cold feet. Her whole body may be cold now, I'm not sure. No, Nikki backed down, of course, because she realized that she just couldn't do it. Now, you can't tell me that someone in that business is not, in any business, is not interested in making $1 million as a reward for proving that what they say is true. And it can be easily proven with a simple test that she would design in its entirety. And then, of course, she has to agree with that we'll have it done independently by some people that she trusts and that we trust. That's the way we do the Million Dollar Challenge. She knew very well. First of all, she's saying now that the Million Dollars doesn't exist. And she also had a statement recently. I love that. There's going to be a problem with the atmosphere on the moon. I think so. I think so, because, Nikki, the atmosphere on the moon, let me see, the density is 0.0000, I believe. And there may be a digit way down the line someplace there. There is no atmosphere on the moon, Nikki, so don't worry about the moon's atmosphere. And ladies and gentlemen, don't get panicky and start to take deep breaths of oxygen while you can still get it. No, the moon is not going to affect us, and the atmosphere of the moon is quite intact. In other words, it's not there.
One of these common things that the psychics say is that first the $1 million doesn't exist, and then they might say something like the skeptics present an atmosphere that prevents the psychic energies from occurring. I'm sure you've gotten that one a few times over the years.
Well, those claims are the most common ones, and in response, yeah, there's no $1 million. No, I checked up on it, there's no $1 million. Well, you see, some years ago we were first hit with this, oh, many years ago, the $1 million doesn't exist. Well, it not only does exist, but we made an offer very clearly, and I've made it many, many times since. If anyone wants evidence that the $1 million exists, it's with an investment firm in Toronto, in New York. Where am I? I got to figure out where I am. This is Vancouver. Okay, I'm back. It's on deposit there. It now amounts to 1.24 or something like that. I've forgotten the exact figure. But it is at least $1 million. It's available there. And if you want proof of it, send us email, make a phone call, use telepathy, tarot cards, whatever you want. Send a phoenix in its beak, if phoenixes have beaks, and I'm not sure. Get in touch with us, and we will provide evidence of that, and notarized evidence, a sworn statement, and you can check with the people who have our $1 million. And it's surprising, but not one person has ever asked for the evidence. But those same people say there is no $1 million. They have to say that, you see, because they know they can't win it.
Mm-hmm. And I assume that $1 million is open to anyone, Canadians, Americans, anyone in the world can apply for the challenge.
Even Canadians, if you can imagine that.
Excellent.
Yes. No, anyone, anywhere in the world. And again, we don't do the tests. They design the tests, the psychics themselves, and I use the word psychic in quotes always, quotation marks, that is. They design it, we approve it, and we may have to adjust it in some way so that it's definitive and we'll know at the end of it, yes or no, whether the test was positive. We don't want any guessing or evaluation or judging or anything like that. It's got to be evident. You know, if you can play the violin, you know right away when you hear the music, if there is any. You don't have to have a judge on that. So the test is very definitive. It's all arranged in advance. They do it themselves and in front of witnesses that they trust. And there's no outs on the thing. We have made that statement, and we are legally constrained to obey the rules. So we are constrained to the point where if they win it, they get the $1 million. If not, they can sue us, and they can get the $1 million plus damages.
Well, hopefully it won't come to that. But I have another Canadian-centric question for you. As you probably know, our head of state is Queen Elizabeth, and we will one day have a king, Prince Charles, who is known to be a big proponent of alternative medicine and critic of GM foods. So what are your thoughts on him using his position as royalty to promote alternative medicine?
Well, I think he was a bad choice in the first place. They shouldn't have given birth to him. But it's done, so we can't do very much about that. And I don't encourage anyone to try. Now, Prince Charles is... What would be a good expression? A dunderhead? Yes, that's a German word. He probably wouldn't understand that. No, he just is not very smart. He accepts anything that sounds... He's like Oprah Winfrey. Oprah Winfrey is a very intelligent lady. She's very accomplished, very talented and everything. And I've enjoyed doing a few programs with her over the years. All I can say is that she believes everything, as Prince Charles does, everything that sounds good and sounds pleasant and easy to accept. But there's no scientific evidence behind any of these things. And yet he seems to think that from his position of royalty, he's got some special privilege where if he decides it's the real thing, it is. He's wrong, wrong, wrong.
What are your thoughts on the monarchy in general?
Oh, I think we've grown out of that. We should have grown out of that. They grew out of, in the United States, it was called a revolution, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They did that instantaneously. Now... I think that most Brits, and most of the Brits that I know personally, and I won't name any of them, but I would say that they know that the monarchy is at an end. And I think with this recent royal marriage, that began to become evidence. It's got a tattered edge, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they should retire the whole idea.
So the JRF doesn't usually weigh in on matters relating to secular humanism. But for you personally, what current events concern you as a secular humanist?
Well, we can't, as you say, that's not the purpose of our existence, of course. But we support in various ways by attending their functions and endorsing their statements and such, the secular humanists in general. I have never had any argument with them. Well, some minor differences, perhaps, but no serious argument. They're pursuing truth. They're pursuing the facts. They're pursuing evidence. And I think we share that very, very strongly.
Excellent. And how do you feel about applying skepticism to issues outside of science, like politics, sociology, or history?
Oh, I think it'd be a very, very good idea. I think if we'd been more skeptical... rather than just kicking the tires, we'd like to lift the hood on the automobile, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But that isn't done very often, and perhaps for good reason. We don't really want a lot of people to know about what's going on in our minds and what we're actually doing. And if they get skeptical, they may want to know about that sort of thing. So it's not encouraged. I think that politicians and many people with ulterior motives want to suppress skepticism. They think it's an unhealthy situation. On the other hand, I also must say that you don't want to be, if you're skeptical, you don't want to let that start to be cynicism. Pardon me. I can't even say the word, you see. Cynicism is a dangerous way to go. Stay skeptical, but don't be cynical.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a bit about your next book, A Magician in the Laboratory.
Well, that's coming along, and I'm working on it. I've got, you see, a pile of paper on the corner of the table there. That's chapters that have been shaped up, and I'm going to be proofreading them during this next 8 days in Canada here with great delight, and make the corrections and enter them into the computer, print them out again, and do it all over again. It's got 26 chapters. It's a long book. And it's coming along very, very, very well. The computer, of course, is a great help. I don't know how I could have done my other books without the computer. And I don't have to do paste and glue and tape things into a condition like I had to before. I had to get bundles of paper all over the floor before I submitted it to the publishers. The poor folks, but now that it's on the computer, it makes it much much more concise and practically error-free. I'm very happy to have the computer age working for me. Finally, at the age of 83, I conquered it.
Excellent. And what would you recommend for someone who wants to get into skepticism? What kind of book or literature would you recommend they start reading?
Well, I would seriously suggest any of my books, which handle the subject, I think, tolerably well. Richard Dawkins, of course, should be somebody that's read. And you should also go to Google, go to the internet, and find out, whatever city or town you're in, look around for some skeptical group that meets. You'd be surprised. There are skeptical groups in almost every, certainly in every major city in the United States of America, or Canada, certainly. But, on the other hand, there will be towns that will also have skeptical groups. And you may find one that's just down the street from where you are, of people that meet every week or every month, or at least send around a newsletter of some kind. And if you contribute to that, you'll come to the attention of other folks. And one glorious day, you may be actually invited to come to speak to one of the amazing meetings. And it would be my delight to invite you.
Excellent. Many critics say that skepticism takes the wonder out of the world. Now, I think wonder is a great aspect of everything that we enjoy in our life, but how do we keep wonder and awe in skepticism?
Read something by Richard Dawkins.
Mm.
He has a wonderful, well, Carl Sagan as well, of course. Both those gentlemen, in their writings and in their pronouncements in public and their essays and magazine articles and whatnot, have shown us that the universe is far, far more wonderful than we can ever imagine. It's exciting to see a picture taken by the Hubble telescope, for example, and blow it up, as I have a couple blown up in my home, and realize that every pixel, every tiny fragment of pigment on the surface of that photograph is bigger than we can possibly imagine. Every pixel in a photograph represents galaxies beyond count. The size of the universe is just so vast, so exciting. And to think you look up, I told this to a kid, and we were looking at Jupiter through a telescope that I had outside my home, a Questar telescope, which I very much adore, and I set it up to show some visitors, set it up on a tripod, and Jupiter was out at the time, and we looked at Jupiter, and some kids came by on a bicycle and stopped and said, "What you doing, mister?" And I asked them to look inside, and I said, "Now, that image took so many seconds to reach your eyes at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, And oh, I'm in Canada, I should say, in kilometers. Right? Yes, I'm sorry. I offend you. I'm sorry. But the kids went, wow. And I said, it's not actually there. But wait a minute. And I swung around, and I got Andromeda in sight. And I said, take a look at that. Yes. There's a fuzzy patch there. Take your eye away from a bit. Oh, yes, I can see it. Oh, it's a big oval thing. Yeah. And the light that came from that, and I've forgotten the figure now, but something like 21 million years, traveling at 186,000 miles per second. That's not the Andromeda Nebula. That's the way it looked that number of millions of years ago. Wow. Now, if that doesn't impress a kid or any, or an adult, come on, anyone, then they can't be impressed. Science is so wonderful and so vast and so exciting. And why do you need all the, what's the technical term for it, crapiola? Why do you need all that nonsense? Science is so exciting that you can't get enough of it if you have any brain whatsoever. And all of our listeners, all the people hearing my voice right now, if you haven't got a science book around, or a book on astronomy, or a book by Dawkins, or any of these people, get it and read it. You may find out that you can't put the book down, mm-hmm. and that's a great sign.
So, looking at the current skeptical movement, what do you think is that we're doing right, and what would you think could we do better as a skeptical movement?
Well, I think we're doing very well. I don't know if I can improve upon it very much because, first of all, I take a certain amount of credit for it. The JREF, the James Randi Educational Foundation, has to take credit for a certain amount of that. We are now pretty well the most outstanding organization of this nature in the world today because we attract the greatest number of people. And as you'll notice at the last time, we had lots of women there. And they're not women that came with their husbands because their husbands are going to this funny thing in Las Vegas where they're going to talk about skepticism and such. No, they came because they're the people who were interested, as well as their husbands. And we had young people there, and we had people of color and a variety of people. Well, as I say, 30 countries were represented there at the last one. That's heartening and rather numbing in a way. Where are we going to do the next one? We have to build our own casino, you see. Mm-hmm. They're not getting large enough. No, the point is that we have made those great strides. We're blossoming. We're moving out in all directions now. And there must be many more skeptics than there were about 10 years ago. It's not only doubled. I'm sure it's many times over that figure. It has made great progress, pardon me, and it has... it started to affect more of society. People are becoming aware of it. Now, we're sold out in many places in Canada already, and we haven't even done the first meeting. Mm-hmm. That's encouraging.
The skeptical movement really depends on the donations of the public. Were you concerned with the economic recession that people would donate less to skeptical organizations?
Oh, yes, of course, and it has proven to be so, yes. People write us a sad little email saying, gee, I can't continue, but maybe next year. And we have to understand that, of course, mm-hmm. because this is a secondary interest. It may be a primary interest to some people. To many people, it's only a secondary interest, but it has to take second place to family and to survival of the property and whatnot. We thoroughly understand that. We're having a hard time, like everyone else, making our ends meet, but we do it somehow. And... We're moving along all right. We can't really complain. Certainly not as much as we might. We try to keep calm in the face of adversity, and I think that's good advice for everybody these days. It will get better. It's got to get better.
And the JREF is moving its headquarters to Los Angeles, California. Mm-hmm. Why the move from Florida?
Well, for one thing... The Florida, certainly Fort Lauderdale, Florida, is not a news center, to say the least. We've done very, very well there, and I'm maintaining my home there, too. I will stay in Florida. And it's moving to Los Angeles, and certainly to California, but we believe Los Angeles, and our president, DJ Grothy, and Sadie Crabtree, our publicity agent there, they both live very closely together, and they will be looking. They are right now looking for a permanent headquarters for the JRF. We think we found one in a very interesting site, which will amuse a lot of people when they find out exactly where it's being located. Secret. We can't tell. If the contract works out. Yes, because it's a publicity center, a news center for the whole country. So that's going to be much more advantageous for us. And I'm not sad to see it move out of Fort Lauderdale. Fort Lauderdale treated us very well. We started there. We were nourished there. We grew there. And now we're going to move to Los Angeles.
And Los Angeles has a pretty active skeptical community.
Yes.
The Skeptic Society is based there, as well as CFI Los Angeles.
Yep.
Will the JREF be working with them on any upcoming projects?
Oh, of course. Of course, yes. We've always worked with them, and more in recent years, as a matter of fact. So that'll be a there may be, see, it may not be a wise idea to move to Los Angeles, because we may attain critical mass with all that intellect there, you see. The place will go up in a mushroom cloud. I better reconsider this now.
Oh, don't do that on my part. But you'll be near Hollywood. Does that mean maybe you'll do more talk shows, perhaps go on the Tonight Show again?
Oh, well, Jay Leno is not very fond of our attitude.
Really?
No. He wants, his people just told me, no, we want entertainment. This is the entertainment business. He doesn't consider that to be, well, you know, Johnny Carson was an exception.
Yeah.
He was an entertainer, too, and he wanted pizzazz, and he wanted the right people on the program. But when we approached him with our ideas, I mean, what I personally, because the JRF didn't exist then, he always grabbed on. In fact, he plugged us into shows where we weren't due. He just simply told Fred DeCordova, his producer at the time, he simply said, oh, no, we'll bump a couple of starlets, and we'll let them in. I hope those starlets aren't after me. But nonetheless, he was very, very generous to us. I miss John. Miss John a lot.
He was a really great promoter of humanism and skepticism.
And a hell of a close-up magician, too.
Yeah.
Not many people knew that. We magicians knew it. But he never did a trick on the show. Can you imagine?
Mm.
But he was good at it.
Oh, yes.
He took lessons from the very greatest in the business. Had them right there in Hollywood.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to ask you a question. If you were to start the skeptical career all over again from the very beginning, would you do anything differently?
I don't know. I'd have to think seriously about that. No, I think it came along at the right time, and it flourished at the right time. I think we're doing very well. I don't know that I would do anything very much different, particularly in view of the success that it's having right now. Look at this Turricanda. It essentially sold out. Boom. Mm-hmm. Well before I even got here. And that's good. That's very encouraging. And I can't wait to see so many of my friends and family here in Canada and show them what's become of the crazy old guy with the long beard.
Well, I was at TAM, and many Canadians were at TAM.
Oh,
so
yes.
You'll have lots of friends taking pictures and mm-hmm. shaking your hand. So it's going to be a really fun trip, I bet.
And doing hugging to you, Sam. Very big on hugs.
Absolutely.
Very big on hugs, yes.
Well, Randy, thank you so much for being on the show and helping us out once again on Radio Free Thinker, and I hope you'll join us again in the future.
I will. Thank you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker, so our thanks to James Randy for the interview, and wish him the best on the rest of his Canadian tour. Well, we're out of time here on the show, so this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And Jenna saying the real world, Don, oh yes, is amazing.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
To the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. A cosmos.